We have noted on the other evenings that we would devote a little time to certain marginalia concerning General Pike and some of the points in connection with his life and research, which we think may be of interest to those of our students who are searching for better foundation work in early comparative religion. Well, when I was in Washington a number of years ago, it occurred to me that it was quite possible that Brady, the Civil War photographer, who is famous for his photographs of Grant and Lincoln and other outstanding persons of the period, might have done something pictorially in connection with General Pike. The House of the Temple did not have any records that such were the case, but I browsed around Washington and I found out that Brady had taken some pictures of General Pike, and I was able to secure one, which I think is not too bad, for it shows the general in one of his most natural and picturesque postures, working with his oversized German pipe, which he greatly favored. This is one of Brady's photographs of General Pike, taken probably in the early 80s, when the general was, as he called it himself, in the prime of his advancing years, which is a rather good term for it, I think. So I thought perhaps it would be nice to show you this picture, and later why you can look at it more in detail if you wish to. We seem to be without any place to put it, so we hope the general will not feel humiliated. I'm sure he would not. Now, also in connection with this point, I'd like to make a few remarks based upon an early study of General Pike, which records a phase of him which I do not find in any of his official biographies. This is by illustrious brother Henry Ridgely Evans, Grand Tyler of the Supreme Council of the Ancient and Accepted Scottish Rite. He says, General Pike was deeply versed in the philosophy of Vedanta. This is something that we perhaps might not be quite so well acquainted with, and as much, of course, as this was many years before the great World Congress of Religions, which brought the Swami Vivekananda to this country. And up to that time, only a very few individuals, perhaps Emerson and a few others, were really aware of this particular philosophy. The author of this article continues, with all his studies in the mysticism of the Orient, he ever maintained his mental equipoise, his fine analytic and discriminating power. All that he wrote was tempered with philosophic insight. He fully appreciated the spiritual profundities of the Vedas and the Zendavesta, and sought to link the Orient with the Occident. He was indeed an emperor of the East and West, which incidentally is a Masonic term, whose true symbol was the double-headed eagle. This point that he was acquainted with and familiar with, a subject such as Vedanta, sort of moves him again into a slightly different category when we are studying the things that he did. A little human episode, I think, is indicative of Pike's position. We know that he lived in one of the most turbulent periods in American history, and that he was in the middle of it, that practically all of his life, until he finally retired to Washington, D.C., was in the field as a pioneer in law and letters, in poetry and in military strategy, and many, many other things. But in the year 1886, John Hallam was at that time writing his biographical and pictorial history of Arkansas. Incidentally, Pike had been one of the first citizens of Arkansas. Begged General Pike to give him some facts concerning his varied and picturesque career. Pike complied with the request, remarking, "I have often refused to write an autobiographical sketch for publication, not through delicacy or modesty, but because I could truly say with the needy knife grinder, 'Story, God bless you, I have none to tell, sir. None I know that would be worth anyone's reading. I am perfectly conscious that I have no aptitude for that type of authorship, and that if I were to undertake it, the result would be stale, flat, and unprofitable. And General Pike, to the end of his life, insisted that nothing interesting had ever happened to him. This is another sidelight on a very interesting man, but shows some of the peculiarities that we often find with that type of person. I'm fine, I have all these things spread out just the way I want them. Now, I want to point out one situation that Pike faced early in his studies of comparative religion, because I think it has a direct bearing on our work this evening. While he was still practicing law in Arkansas and recovering from the numerous trials and tribulations of the Civil War, he was working on his manuscripts, and one of the most interesting of these is the Indo-Aryan Deities and Worship, in which he attempts a study of the Rig Veda. In introducing this subject, Pike goes over most of the available authorities of his time and points out that there is a serious difficulty which no one seems to have been able to solve. And that is that we not only have to find out what the original author meant, but when we find out and we make even a most accurate and careful translation, we are still in no position to know that we have transmitted his idea. This is a very difficult situation, because we have to use words that were unknown to him. We have to take concepts for which he had particular terms, and we have to try to find some way of expressing things familiar to him in words that he never heard of. Now, it's not only that we might be wrong, but he cannot use censorship over the fact that his own language has changed, that even the most careful scholarship runs against a number of very difficult situations, as I attempted to point out in one of the earlier talks building up to this particular point. And in order to explain his own position, General Pike gives us some interesting words and terms which we all use every day, and then asks us what they mean. And so in this particular context, I think it might be interesting to follow some of his researches in words just for maybe 5 minutes to see how he approached a problem which most scholars have never yet been able to solve in a manner satisfactory to others, even if satisfactory to themselves. As a very good scholar in Latin and Greek, Pike chose a good many of his terms for consideration at this moment from these languages because of their gradual descent into our popular tongue. He starts here by giving us the word sacrament. Now, that is a term which we think we know what it means. But let us see, according to Pike, what the original word meant. Now, supposing we found in a text the Latin term sacramentum, just exactly what do we mean? Do we mean that this individual took some holy and sacred obligation, or something of that kind? Literally not. That is not the meaning of the word. The word means a deposit or a pledge made by a party in a legal suit in Rome. In other words, it begins as a legal term. Afterwards, it meant a military oath, usually an obligation to Caesar or the state. And after that, it meant any kind of an oath on any subject, and finally moved into our usage, which actually does not mean an oath at all. We do not have the same meaning whatsoever. Now, a word that we all use a great deal, Pike gives a little study to, and that is the word pagans. We now think of pagans as people whose faith is different from ours, or who do not believe in one of the three religions to which we do not apply the term pagan, namely Christianity, Muslimism, and Judaism. All other religions we consider as pagan. Pike tells us, for example, that the Pagani were originally those people who lived in small villages and towns. That's what it means. Just a small town, folks. And that the that as Christianity, in its development, gathered to itself more and more of those living in metropolitan areas or in the larger communities, those who were not converted were the ones in the small towns and in the distant places and in the villages and on the farms and things of that nature, where the doctrine had actually not reached. Therefore, those who had not yet heard about it, and therefore did not believe in it, were the village dwellers, or the pagans. And that's all the term means, actually. It has nothing to do with whether you're a good man or a bad man or a true believer or a false believer. It simply means that you lived out on a farm or in some small town where you did not enjoy the advantages of being able to listen to the sermons of the various preachers. That's approximately all the word means. But it certainly doesn't mean that anymore. And if the word pagan has come into ill repute, Pike points out, the poor word heathen is in still worse trouble. Now, what is a heathen? A heathen is supposed to be a false person in false religious conviction. Therefore, it may be interesting to know that the word heathen originally meant one of the wild tribe of Germans who lived on the heaths. In other words, it was a heath dweller, a person who lived out in these great lands. And, of course, something like the pagans or the small town people were a little outside of the odor of sanctity. It hadn't got there yet. So when we say to a man today, I think you're a heathen, I wonder if we really mean we think he lives on a wild heath and that also he is of Teutonic extraction. We probably do not. But when these words are used, we have trouble with them. And we also have trouble wherever popular idiom gradually changes the meaning of things. A few more of his thoughts here would also perhaps be pleasant. The word passion originally simply meant suffering. So when an individual is described as passionate, it means he is suffering severely. Now that may not be perhaps quite the meaning we have now, but that's what it originally means. Now, Pike, perhaps by the law of association, as advanced by Dr. Seabury, also came to the conclusion that he should put the word libertine along with the passionate man. Perhaps this is just an idea. But what does the word libertine mean? We have an idea that it means an individual of loose morals. Maybe you'll be surprised to read, to find that the original meaning is a free thinker. A libertine is an individual who dared to think his own thoughts. A liberal. But hardly is that the meaning with which we associate the word today. The word plague, meaning now an epidemical disease or some malady of that kind, merely means to be struck a blow. Well, of course, actually, I suppose if you get the plague, it is a bit of a blow. But anyway, it means to strike a blow. And our word pain does not mean suffering at all. It means punishment. Well, perhaps it's true that many times our pain is a form of punishment. Perhaps the older man was wiser than we are. But when an individual says he is in pain, it means he is under punishment. But again, we have lost the meaning of that. I like the original meaning of the word obsolete. We think of it, for instance, as meaning something that is far behind, out of style, no longer used, and so on. It means, actually, that a thing has lost its odor. A bouquet of flowers which no longer have any scent might be said to be obsolete. Because it has to lose its savor, its smell, or its scent in order to be obsolete. Well, I don't know, but that's a rather a stretch from our present meaning. We also have the word derivative, which we incline to to relate to the term derive, or to come from. It actually means to take water out of the river. Now, you can imagine what you'd have to do when you start reading sacred books, trying to figure out the difference between popular meaning and real meaning, or between original meaning and surviving meaning. It could be very difficult. Attached means to put your finger out and touch something. It doesn't mean to take hold of it or to be fastened to it. It merely means to touch it. That again would be a form of attachment that would be rather gentle for our present thinking. We have the word firmamentum, which we now tie with the concept of firmament or heaven. Originally, firmament was a foundation for a fort. It arises from our term fortis, which means to fortify or to make strong, and strength, prop, to hold up. Well, it now means the sky, which would scarcely be entirely in the original thinking. When we endorse a man's character, it means simply that we do something on his back, from in dorso, on the back. So we can endorse a check on the back. That is quite correct. But when we endorse a man's character, it means we would have to sign an affidavit on his back or something of that kind to make our meaning actually true. Our word disposition actually means to put in order. And how many people's dispositions are worthy of that claim? And finally, Pike gives us the term provisions, now meaning food, from provisio, which simply means foresight. Therefore, foresight, perhaps associated with the animal storing up its food for the winter, is the origin of our word provision. It does not mean actually foodstuff now, but we think of putting away foodstuff as foresight against hunger. Now, these are examples that he gives to show what happens when you start trying to put languages together or take them apart, for that matter, and that it's much easier sometimes to take them apart than it is to put them together. And he also points out that it is much easier to differ from the authorities than it is to correct them. And that difference is easy, but to come up with something that is really solutional is not quite so easy. So this is another little insight, not only into his thinking, but perhaps into relatively important thinking for all of us in connection with the exactness of terms. Now, in his researches into the Persian religion, Pike takes an attitude which perhaps is rather important to us. It might mean that before we get through with it, we'll spend a good deal of the evening on his attitude, but I think it is one that is essentially valuable. And strangely enough, he does not make this basic concept from a quotation from the Avesta, or one of the sacred books of the Persians, but from the Phaedo of Plato. He quotes Socrates, where Socrates says of the great initiatory institutions of the ancients, "It well appears that those who established the mysteries or secret assemblies of the initiates were no contemptible personages, but men of great genius, who in the early ages strove to teach us under enigmas that he who shall go to the invisible region without being purified will be precipitated into the abyss, while he who arrives there, purged of the stains of this world and accomplished in virtue, will be admitted to the dwelling place of the deity. The initiated are certain to attain to the company of the gods." This is from Socrates. Now, this is basically the premise upon which a very large part of his Avestan researches are based. First of all, then, let us try to restore his thinking. According to Pike, the researches in the early and basic religions of the Persians have led him to certain conclusions. One is that what we call the stream of the ancient Persian wisdom is one of the earliest streams of religious knowledge in the world. That it probably goes back far enough so that Pike says in the opening of his lectures on the Aryas, referring to the Rig Veda, he says, the second oldest book in the world. He does not at that point name the oldest, but from the general consensus of his thinking, he does not believe necessarily that the Avestas are the oldest, but he believes that the stream of tradition, which later became embodied in the Avestic literature, is one, if not the earliest, certainly the earliest that we can identify of the great wisdom religious systems of the world. Now, Pike apparently had some reservations concerning the interpretation of the Persian sacred writings by the Persians themselves. He seems to have taken the ground that the ancient Persian writings are not much more available to the average modern believer today, and are not available in very much better condition than the sacred writings of most other great peoples. In other words, he takes the attitude that there is a peculiar and strange dark curtain that has fallen over all religions. That this curtain fell at some undetermined date, and he likes to symbolize it by the fact that each religion of the world passes through the experience of losing the key to its own doctrine. That this key becomes lost. The books don't become lost. The descent of the hierarchs, the priests and the teachers, this descent does not seemingly cease. But there seems to be a point in all the religions of men where certainty fades away, and where in the place of certainty man falls into opinion, and in the place of assurance of things he falls into interpretation, about which there is an endless divergence of opinion. And Pike takes the point that wherever there is a tremendous division of opinion, there is a poverty of fact, because we are not divided on any matter in which we are certain. We are divided by our uncertainties, particularly in matters of religion and philosophy. And if the primordial religion of man was available in its original pristine beauty, Pike takes the ground that probably no one would resent it or oppose it. But that all down through time, there has been a falling away from the power of exactitude, and that in this great drift of ages, marked by the destruction of ancient works, by the scattering of peoples, by the gradual interchange of racial beliefs and doctrines, that the purities of the lines of descent of tradition have gradually been corrupted. So that today, as he expresses it in his own words, religion has gradually moved into the position of a powerful ethical structure of believing, and that religion today is measured by the individual's acceptances of certain things as true, the acceptances of certain ethical codes, about which there seems to be less division of opinion than upon more abstract theological questions. Thus men still are more or less agreed as to the nature of honesty, but they are not at the moment in very solid agreement as to the nature of first cause, or any of these great abstractions which mark the foundations or beginnings of practically all of the world's faiths. Thus Pike takes the attitude that there is a key which opens the structure of these ancient teachings, and that this key is lost. If not lost, it is unfortunately mislaid. It is not available to us when we most need it and most want it. And in the place of this key, men have fashioned many keys, and some of them seem to fit fairly well. But it was Pike's opinion that these keys did not actually turn the lock correctly, that they did not make available the point which is of the greatest basic interest or the greatest basic value. Pike then points out that his assumption is based upon a number of points which he considers to be highly relevant. He sees in a certain central area involving the great complex of Persian Aryan peoples a center from which, radiating outward in almost all directions, streams of culture flowed like rivers of life to make fertile the religions and cultures of a great many peoples. He is convinced from his study of ancient languages and ancient teachings that there are vestiges, evidences, fragments, perpetuations of this ancient Iranian faith to be found in almost all of the surviving religions of the world. He believes also that to a great degree many of these faiths are the direct outgrowth of ideas and teachings which have apparently vanished in their own homeland, that they are no longer available in the place where they came from, and that by degrees they have moved away into these other groups. But Pike points out, if all of these other groups hold certain doctrines, ideas, or principles in common, and all these groups have a certain dependency, which is obvious in their ritualism, obvious in their symbolism, obvious even in their languages, then the various productions which arise as the result of this central force must have within themselves some more than incidental borrowings, some more than incidental fragments of the original teaching. Thus Pike, beginning, for example, by studying the Kabbalah and the ancient writings in the Valley of the Euphrates, moving into Hinduism and Buddhism, going down into Egyptian philosophy, and finally over into Greek philosophy, particularly the Orphic and Pythagorean schools, he finds in all of these groups indications that a tradition of some kind, a tradition no longer directly available, even in the Persian religion, came from Persia, or came from that general area, and that this tradition, carried to a dozen other localities, has survived in all of these localities. Therefore, at least potentially, it must be assumed that they were also in the original locality, which was the source of these migratory procedures. Pike, then, in his researches, was seeking for the evidence of what he regarded as the essential principles of the wisdom religion. He was convinced that when he refers to the wisdom religion, he is referring to something that had a valid existence. He is not merely speaking, in his thinking, of an abstract symbolic term. He is thinking that there was, at a remote time, a highly organized faith, a more or less complete or total structure of religious insight. That this religious insight was not theological primarily, but completely philosophical and scientific. In other words, he is probing for what the alchemists in the Middle Ages called the exact science of human salvation. He believes that such a science existed, that this science was just exactly as orderly and inevitable as mathematics, and that the regeneration of man is a process for which there is an exact methodology, that this methodology underlies the so-called claims, or to some people, pretensions of ancient peoples to possess this knowledge. And Pike is convinced that men of the caliber of Socrates and of Plato and of Pythagoras and many others in other parts of the world could not have been deceived in this matter. That these men were aware that religion divides into two distinct parts, that the core of it, the essential part of it, is this sacred science, which he calls the wisdom religion. And that the second part of it was the sacerdotal art, or the theological aspect, which had as its perhaps its prominent and most important function that of the ethical development of man. Pike therefore goes on to take the position that it was the purpose of this twofold structure to continue to bring to the attention of men, of mortal persons, the tremendous need for the enlightenment, improvement, and perfection of themselves. That the outer part of this, or the exoteric body of religion, consisted of a great group of moral, ethical virtues. Virtues founded in purification, consecration, devotion. And that the individual who accomplished to a great degree these matters was entitled, as he points out in the early Persian lore, to seek and find one of the holy teachers, the good ones, who could show him the way to that which was locked behind the veil of the inner teaching. Thus, the virtues constituted the probationary part of religion. That the living of the good life, the thinking of the good thought, these qualities made man ready to know. Because by means of these qualities, man claimed the moral birthright of his own humanity. Man stood up then and said, I am worthy. I have proved my worthiness. But Pike does not believe that religion ends in the proof of worthiness. This is important. It is the beginning. But that the good man is not the complete and total purpose of religion. That the purpose of religion is that it shall take over in some mysterious way the good man and make him the truly wise man. And that the wise man in this case is the individual who has received the secrets of the divine life. The secret of the release of his own godhood, and the secret of the means by which he will ultimately be restored to unity with the total divinity of life and space. That this has to be an exact process. That hoping, believing will help, but that just as hoping and believing will not allow an inexperienced man to perform a delicate piece of surgery, or even a great and devout believing will enable a man who has never played the piano to become instantly a musician. So hope and believing are not in themselves substitutes for actual knowledge. That they are the moral forces by which man is sustained in his search for knowledge. But that this knowledge stands apart, stands like some strange mysterious sphinx upon the desert of waiting. And that this sphinx, locking within itself the secret of man's divine birthright, that this sphinx must be questioned by a knowing Oedipus who is able to take from the sphinx the secret of its riddle, and thus end forever the mystery with which truth is shrouded. To attain this purpose, then, Pike begins to search what he calls the monuments of time, to discover whether his position is valid. In his work on the Indo-Aryans that we have just mentioned, Pike says in the preface that this monograph was never intended for publication. It represented only his own research, and it was not published until many years after his death. It was simply the record, the daily record of his own searching. It was the step-by-step unfoldment of his own purpose. And he said many steps had to be retraced and taken over again, and that he had to discard along the way many of the most attractive so-called discoveries that he had made. And he insists in this preface also that as a lawyer, as a thinker, as a man of training, he did not reason from a conclusion. He tried to reason toward one, keeping his mind open to negation even to the end, willing to accept any absolute truth or complete fact, even though it swept away the entire work that he had accomplished. His purpose was, if possible, to reveal what he felt might be there, but which he could not accept until he had subjected it to the most careful analysis. But at the end of his writing, he tells us that he was fortified in his hope, and that although much vanished along the way, and he was forced to break with many authorities, long held as almost sacred, he came finally to the conclusion that the evidence in favor of the original concept was irrefutable, and that this evidence perhaps is nowhere as obvious as it is in this circle, this diameter of the wheel, in which the various nations of the world all indicate that they shared with him this absolute conviction that there was a universal knowing, a universal wisdom reality, and that this universal wisdom reality was certainly of far greater antiquity than we are normally inclined to suspect. Searching further in this field, Pike felt conclusively necessary that we begin to push back the historical boundaries of what we term the era of light. Instead of assuming that light came to this world 3,000 years ago, or 4,000 years ago, or that man became a sapient creature 5,000, 6,000, 10,000 years ago, that we have to begin to push back this search for the origin of the enlightened man. Actually, it was Pike's conviction that man as man was created or fashioned or came into existence, whether by evolutionary or other processes, that the human being from the beginning possessed the instinct of intelligence, that this instinct of intelligence, gradually developing over a great period of time, accomplished far more in its so-called early phases than we are inclined to suspect. Pike rejects actually and completely the emergence of an enlightened man 7,000 or 8,000 years ago. Even though we cannot, by means of any existing historical record, discover the rational pre-Egyptian, the rational pre-Greek, the rational pre-Semite, Pike insists that this being existed, or that these beings existed, and that actually the streams of our tradition are far older than we suspect, and what we call history is nothing but the record of the decline of truth. Now, the reason why it is a record of the decline of truth is that it, like the history of a man, is a long unfolding record of his death. Because that part of his history, which is concerned primarily with his life, actually occurs before he is born. In his prenatal period, man is growing. From the moment he is born, he is dying. The moment birth takes over, the forces of crystallization begin to set in. And in this process of gradual dying, man passes through varying degrees of death process. When he achieves what we call maturity, he has come to the fine point of the equilibrium between life and death. In that period, therefore, we regard him as having a maximum maturity and a maximum efficiency. But what do we mean? We mean that by the time he is 35 to 45 years of age, he has reached the point where his materiality is becoming established and his spirituality is already three-quarters dead. We are coming to the point where, through compromise of principles, he is making economic progress that is satisfactory. He has already died out of something. He has died out of the dreams of youth. He has died out of a great many hopes. He is becoming factual, which is another term for crystallized. Therefore, the history of our peoples, the history of the world as we know it, is the gradual process of man dying. Now, it cannot be a total picture because men are forever being born. But a moment an institution, a system, an ideological structure comes into existence, that moment it begins to die. So we have the long record of things fading away. And the things that fade first are the memories, apparently, of old things, of first things. Because in the struggle of life, we forget the dreams of youth. So by degrees, we reintegrate or reorganize our concepts, becoming ever more practical, ever more factual, discarding as lore, legend, and fairy tale things that were once the real values of our lives. Thus we have at the root of history legendary and lore, golden ages and mysterious heavenly abodes. And as we got wiser and wiser, which means in this case deader and deader, we began to forget these things and lose them. First thing you know, we began to say these legends are for children. But children are the young, children are the alive. Therefore there is an aliveness gradually fading away. And Pike makes a long and careful study of this aliveness. He makes a very painstaking research to show why and how each generation has persecuted the prophets. How each generation has little by little revised and restored and reinterpreted and reintegrated, and every time it did it, something was lost. Until finally, great things were reduced to the ignorance of man, which is the exact reverse of our basic process. Instead of man rising to greatness, he drew greatness down to himself until it became less and less great. And the less great it became, the more willingly he accepted it. But when it reached a certain degree of not being great, it became such a caricature of itself that man began to ridicule the procedure and reject the very things which he had himself had brought about. Thus, out of the gradual degeneration of things also rose skepticism, or a general disillusionment about knowledge or the essence of fact itself. This position causes Pike to look back, and he would like to find, or would like to believe, from his researches, that the great structure of this basic doctrine was in a strange, pristine purity between 7 and 10,000 years before the beginning of the Christian era, perhaps much longer. But he wants to be as conservative as he can. He believes that this revelation, this basic knowledge, preceded the first of the Zoroasters. He believed that they drank at its fountain as all others did. He believes very definitely that the entire philosophy of the Zoroastrian doctrine is rooted in this thing, which, like the mysterious principle at the root of Zoroastrianism itself, an absolute, an infinite, an ultimate and utter state of existence, that this eternal life itself was man's primordial symbol of eternal wisdom, that this mysterious power at the very source of things, Ahura Mazda, or whatever level he goes beyond and behind that concept also, but that this creating power, the source of all wisdom, the one who communicates to his saints and sages, the mysterious power that is forever the oracle, was not merely the voice of a deity, not merely something that appeared in thunders, but was actually a statement of the existence of a holy order, a sacred body of enlightened beings, human by nature, with a strange but total penetration into reality. And that everything that has since followed has come from that, and has gradually, in the course of time, fallen away from that until we have relatively forgotten the original teachings of the ancient ones of the earth. Now let us see how Pike would proceed with this, because he realized that he would be open to criticism for such a statement. He would realize that someone would say, but these persons could not have known this, they could not have known that. Certainly we have made some advancements in knowledge. Certainly as we look back, we find indication of man living in a more and more primitive state. Certainly the whole trend of our concept is that man has arisen from darkness into light. Pike, however, doesn't think so. Pike says man has fallen from light into darkness. because of a false estimation of what constitutes light, or perhaps a false definition of the meaning of darkness. Whichever term you wish to use, man has come to a false explanation of the meaning of the term, or a false concept of origin based upon it. Now Pike then points out another interesting situation. Namely, that when we would destroy truth, we must complicate it. We must make it difficult. And the more difficult we make it, the more difficult it is for anyone to find out anything. Of course, Pike does not use the story, but I think I have told it, but it is a rather cute one, to the effect that one day two men were walking along side by side, one a human soul and the other the devil. And right in front of them was another man walking by himself. And the man in front leaned over and picked up something, looked at it, and slipped it in his pocket. And the man with the devil said, "What did he pick up?" And the devil said, "Oh, this man has just found a small grain of truth." The man with the devil said to him, "Well, that's going to make it pretty tough for you, isn't it?" The devil said, "Oh, no, I'm going to help him organize it." Now, Pike's thinking on this is exactly this point. He says, we assume that the motion from the primitive to the sophisticated is evolution. And Pike says, I doubt it very, very severely. I think we have longer words to say it with than ever before, but I do not think we know as much about what we're saying. Gradually, by degrees, we have fallen into this opinionism, which, as Heraclitus says, is the falling sickness of the reason, and as a result, we know much about many things and very little of the fact beneath things. So Pike, going back to the beginning, says it wasn't necessary for this ancient body, whatever it may have been, to have been able to square the circle. They didn't need to know trigonometry and calculus. They did not need to write histories. They did not need to compile philosophies. They did not need to develop or originate religions per se, for the simple reason that all of these things belong finally not to the spreading of wisdom, but man's combating of ignorance. Instead of assuming that these are the way man came to know, actually they were the ways in which man began to search for something lost, or something that he believed to be knowable, but which in its substance eluded him. Therefore, direct knowledge, the only knowledge that is true, the knowledge that carries with it the total internal experience of fact, is a kind of knowledge we know nothing about, and we have almost no way of assuming that that essential knowledge is related to the economic, social, or political development of peoples. That this knowledge, like the intuitive power of a child, might be truer and righter than any knowledge that is later conferred upon that child by education and culture. Thus, the ancient ones of the earth were those, in Pike's thinking, who were the natural knowers. Those who had not been led into error, and therefore did not have to be led out of it. He assumes that man naturally was endowed with faculties for the purpose of experiencing truth, and not for the purpose of fighting ignorance. That until man himself created ignorance, it did not exist. For ignorance is an artificial state in nature. Ignorance is not necessary. It originates in false instruction. It originates in systems by means of which man's intuitive and natural faculties are blunted, in which he loses the capacity for the immediate apprehension of fact, and must therefore depend for knowledge upon sharing the opinions of others. Pike therefore refers to these ancient ones of the earth as the lodge of the old teachers, the holy ones of old, those to whom we have constant reference. And he points again to his circumference, and he points out that every religion and philosophy of man traces itself back to a period of legendary and lore when wisdom was universal. In other words, we can think perhaps of the Greek just as a simple example. But in the beginning was the golden age, when there was no poverty, no ignorance, no sickness, no suffering, and no death. This was the divine era. In the ancient childhood of the world, in the oldest Hindu writings, we find originally this world ruled benevolently and eternally by the gods. There was no disobedience, there was no sin. Although the point is rather congested in the opening chapters of Genesis, this point also exists, that presumably the original man lived in a paradisical garden, and here the Lord walked with him in the evening, and he was not ashamed, and he was in communication with the creating powers that had fashioned him and brought him into existence. The same is true of the Egyptian religion, for in the dawn of things there was the golden age, the age of peace and joy, the age before the gods retired to their Olympian strongholds, the age in which nothing but life and peace and happiness prevailed. We find it even among savage people. We find it among our American Indian tribes. For in most of their little local legends, although they are feeble in comparison to the great theological systems of the classical nations, they all begin with the idea that man was happy. They none of them begin with the fact that he was miserable. Nearly all of the systems, and Pike enumerates probably 20 or 30 of them, they all declare that man began in peace, that for thousands of years, millions of years, perhaps aeons of time, there were no wars. Then in one way or another, rebellion set in. There was war in heaven. Some of the angels resisted their Lord. And there was the battle between Michael and Lucifer in the old Jewish legendary. Someone became selfish. Someone became corrupt. And the great and splendid pageantry of the divine will was mutilated and deformed and in measure destroyed by the rise of human will. And man's own egoism, his own selfishness, his own determination to live his own way gradually caused the golden age to die. Pike's one point, however, is well taken, that if we accept that legendary and mythology and lore belongs to a kind of subconscious memory of man, a memory which psychology perhaps says goes back to human infancy with its irresponsibility, but this again only symbolic of collective infancy, the rise and dawn of peoples, he is correct in assuming, at least, that all of the great systems of the world agree on this point. They agree that there was a time when man knew, that Adam could name all creatures according to their natures and their attributes, that the ancient ones communicated with mankind, and in practically every great system of legendary, in the dawn of things, gods walked the earth with men. We do not know just exactly how this is explained in things like the Eldorada, or the Sigurd Saga, or the Fridolf Saga, or the Kalevala, or any of these great epical works based upon the ancient legendary and lore of peoples. We have it in Japan, in the Nohinji and the Kojiki. We have the great sacred writings of the days when the gods ruled the world and men lived in peace. Thus, in the root of things, Pike seemingly took the attitude that all this legendary and lore did not relate merely to a theological abstraction or to some mythological hope or some escape mechanism in man, but that it related distinctly and definitely to a period in which the ancient doctrines, the great wisdom, was directly available to the human being. Directly available to him because he then possessed, by the nature of infancy, the total kind of purity the total kind of innocence by means of which he was without sin. Meaning, of course, if we want to go back to the Chaldean and follow Pike's thinking, without sin means not moonstruck. Because Sin was the ancient goddess of the moon. Therefore, without lunacy, without the moon madness, without this strange thing that led man into illusion, for which the moon was an ancient symbol. Regardless of how we want to think of it, let's see how Pike now begins to defend his position. He defends his position by pointing out that as each of the streams left this central core land and began to establish themselves as separate nations and peoples, began to cause the rise of what we might term existence on an individualized basis, that the first thing that each of these groups did was to restore or recreate or perpetuate what he is referred to by Socrates in this quotation which I read, the state mysteries. Now, the state mysteries lie not at the decadence of people, but at their roots. For by the time of the Orphics, 1400 years B.C., the great mysteries of the Greeks were already in decline. By the rise of the Osirian cycle in Egypt, the great mysteries of the Egyptians had fallen, been revised, reformed, regenerated, and fallen again a dozen times.